Mountainish Podcast.
Stop and start again. I wasn't recording.
What part of Adam are you ready? Didn't you understand?
I thought he meant like spiritually ready.
I'm going to give you my Hirsch's dad voice.
We're physically ready. We're spiritually ready. We're emotionally ready. We're sexually ready. It's time for Pungus Podcast number 458. Let's get it started. Welcome back to the Pung News Podcast. This is Features Editor John Gentile. We've got the Trauma Unit or the New Classic Crew or the Troublemakers or the Dirty Bandits or the Little Rascals. Whatever you want to call us, here we are back again. Of course, it's me, Features Editor John Gentile. We're here with, I guess, Adam, you go by editor kind of guy, Adam White, or contributor Adam White. Or,
not in charge of anything, Adam White.
No legal culpability, Adam White, is what I like to call myself.
There we have it. The Teflon Don himself, Adam White.
You live in a different country, dude. Well, nobody can sue you anyway.
That's true. And speaking of a guy that can be sued, we are also here with a reviews writer, a regular podcaster, an occasional interviewer, an occasional article, feature writer. The man about town, the world's oldest teenager.
I'm getting to be the world's oldest teenager, no question.
We are here with Tom Crandall, Tom Trauma Rock.
Oh my gosh, my Christian name slipped out again.
Tom Trauma, what's happening, baby?
Nothing much, man. How you guys doing?
Doing good. Listen, I mean, just doing our thing. I got a couple of things, and we'll get into it. On the past couple of weeks, we've really been bullshitting a lot. This week, fair amount of news, some pretty interesting stuff, I think. It is the summer doldrums, and that news tends to be a little bit slower, but we got some interesting stuff to jump into. A couple of things I do want to address, though. I'll tell you, boys, it's real hard to be jaded about punk rock in 2019, just because this year and kind of last year, there's been, like, a ton of great stuff coming out recently, hasn't there been? I mean, maybe not, like, amazing, but, like, really, really good stuff's been coming out a lot recently, right?
I mean, I think there's always good stuff, but I still think it's easy to be jaded about it, because the majority of the stuff is still crap.
There's
the world's oldest teenager's opinion.
What do you think? A half empty glass? I mean, that half full glass, and just dump the whole thing out, Tom.
Dude, pretty much not everything, but 90% of the stuff that I've been crazy about this year has been, you know, the band's been around for 30 years. So,
I feel like there's a lot of new cool bands coming up. Adam, I know you feel like there's a lot of new cool bands coming up right about now.
Yeah, I think there's a ton of stuff that's coming out that's all kind of fun and good. It all falls into that usual caveat where you want to say that, like, if you are strictly looking at the punk bands that you were listening to in 1998, then this is probably a pretty boring time.
How about 1988, Adam?
Maybe. I don't know. Aren't they all dead? They're all dead.
But they're down to one original member, most of them.
True. But if you're I've been having a lot of happiness and success listening to punk rock in the 2019 or whatever year it is, but it's none of the bands that I was listening to when I was a teenager. And I think that is the healthy way to keep yourself sane. So whether there are new records or whenever I've like dipped into one of these new records from some band of my youth, from some beloved band of my youth, it's been meh.
But everything from the beloved bands of your youth are from the 90s, so they weren't that good to start with.
Well, I mean, you know,
beloved bands of my youth are from the 80s. They were good. They were good.
I'll tell you, boys, Keith Morris is still destroyed. I saw Off about 4 or 5 weeks ago. Amazing. Amazing.
Your Off is your counterexample for everything. Let's just put Off on the shelf because they didn't really factor into this, I think. But
let's put Off on the shelf because it disproves every theory that you have.
They don't know. It is an outlier to the general trend. And the general trend is that I will go and I will listen to something like, you know, the new Bad Religion record, which is a band that I love and have loved and have, you know, helped shape the person that I am today. And it's so boring. And it, like, it's just,
well, just, that doesn't have anything to do with the fact that you liked it in the 90s as much as the fact that they've just sort of,
no, but I've had that general feeling. Safe
music.
I had that
plus
feeling.
The stuff they were doing in the late 90s was their very worst stuff.
Okay, don't peg a specific year. You know what I'm trying to say. If you read punk news and your read on what's going on in punk rock in 2019 is to listen to the latest stuff from, you know, Bad Religion and Blink 182 and whatever other fucking bands we're talking about still, then you're you would disagree with John's initial premise here that this has been a good year for punk rock. But I think if you're listening to new stuff, yeah, it's been a great year for punk rock. That was the point I was trying.
Well, there have been some older bands that have put out really good albums. And I think that will continue. I've heard the new Subhumans album in its entirety, and it's great. The new Freeze album, great. The new Proletariat album, great. These are all bands that have been around for 35 plus years.
Proletariat's been around for 35 years?
Yeah, they were in that early mid 80s. Their albums were like 83 and 85, and they were actually split apart for 30 years.
I did not know that.
They didn't limp into the 90s. They quit in about the mid 80s. And that new album is really, it's really good, and it's really good, and it's really hard to find, unfortunately. A lot of these old bands signed with these new labels, and there's just no promotion behind it at all. I live to try to bring awareness to these things.
All right, so Tom's arguing the alternate point, to, I guess, to what I was arguing, but maybe it just comes down to you got to listen to the right bands. So listen to Tom Travis.
Oh, I'm listening to the right bands, Adam. Yes. Don't you worry about it.
This is why you are in a position of telling people about things on punk news right now, and I am in a position of doing nothing. And
I really am shaking my stick at you. I'm telling you, there's so much. The majority. I'm trying to think of like a new band that I'm. There's a few new bands I really like, but you know the band Clitorati, they put out a new album this year and it's good. I like
all those people. Clitorati's cool, but they've all been in bands for like 25 years.
Yeah, you're right, but their band is new. I mean, it's maybe like 4 or 5 years old, but no, you're right. I guess that doesn't really prove my point. After, man, who do I like that's really young?
There's a lot of great new young bands, man.
I'm sure there are. I just have to show up in time to see them open for the old bands that I want to go see.
And we'll just talk about this briefly, is unfortunately Pedro Bell passed away. Pedro Bell was the artist for Funkadelic and George Clinton, and he was famous for doing a bunch of like these really weird cartoony but fun, bizarre, psychedelic images for the Funkadelic and George Clinton album covers. Without question, one of the greatest album cover designers ever, maybe the greatest, you know, definitely one of the greatest. He passed away. It was pretty sad. Like, he's one of these guys that never really got his due. Apparently he was pretty broke. I didn't even know this. And I wish I, in the 2010s, he was actually selling original art, and boy, would I love to have one of his pieces. I wish I'd known, you know. I've actually made it a point to like, kind of like buy art by punk rockers that I like, that I think is interesting. Cause you can get like an original painting or picture for like $50, which is like you could buy like, you know, a French press of something you already have, or like original piece of art. And so anyway, it's sad that Pedro Bell passed away. Nobody commented on punk news, which I thought was kind of sad, but I don't know if you guys know Pedro Bell's artwork, but if you don't, you should I mean, his album covers are amazing and exactly perfect for Funkadelic.
I did never heard that name, but I know those covers, the classic like 70s album.
Yeah.
Those are pretty bang and pretty bright, pop right out at you.
Yeah. Anyways, so before we get into the news, there is one thing I want to talk about. Adam and Tom and Adam, I might be going down a dark path, and I might need you guys to pull me out, and here's why. So you guys know that Rob Miller of Amoebics, he recently kind of had some issues recently, which, you know, hopefully that gets sorted out on his end. So anyways, meanwhile, I was at a record store called Vinyl Altar in Philadelphia, which has been there for years. I didn't even heard about it, but it's actually like it's a really good metal and goth record store. And I got, let's see, I picked up some records by Death in June and what the hell's the other band? Soul Invictus. Of course, Death in June and Soul Invictus are the spinoff bands of Crisis. Crisis was a first wave English punk band, and pretty much all their songs are about how much they hate Nazis. And it is, I mean, the Crisis compilation, they only put out, or they put out some singles, but everything's on a compilation called, I think it's called Crisis. It's amazing. It's some of the best English punk ever. After they split up, they started Death in June and then Soul Invictus. Tony Wakeford did Soul Invictus. Douglas P. did Death in June. Although they were both on the first two Death in June albums. Death in June is, we talked about them briefly, but Death in June is a very weird band. It's held by Douglas P. Sometimes he records with, what the hell's the name of that guy? That really weird guy? David Tibet. Sometimes he records with Boyd Rice. And basically, Death in June is a really, really weird band in that Douglas P. is a weird guy. He's very publicly gay. He's a very, I mean, I don't know how you want to phrase that. Everyone knows he's gay. publicly gay. But he like wears camos all the time, and he like wears these weird masks. And I think it's like a symbol for something. But like if you see him live, he wears this creepy mask.
So all those guys I see at the shorts, the shows wearing their camouflage shorts, that's a sign that they're openly gay.
It might be. But the point being is,
watch out, hardcore fans.
But he's like really into S&M and that kind of stuff too. And so, but the problem with Death in June, or not the problem, but is they use a lot of Nazi imagery on their album covers, you know, and they kind of like mix that with like S&M and like imagery. And so people accuse him of being a Nazi. And there's web pages of say, Douglas P's a Nazi, Douglas P's a Nazi. I find it hard to believe that like a publicly gay man could be a Nazi, you know, but I don't know. You know, he's really weird. He's so weird that he moved to Australia in the middle of nowhere, and like I think he's got that condition where he doesn't even want to talk to people. Like he lives by himself and like doesn't want to talk to people at all. You know. Meanwhile, Tony Wakeford, who's Soul Invictus, Soul Invictus actually had an album on the Rock Against Fascism comp, which is of course a pro-Nazi compilation. But they put it on as a joke because they actually put a song about how much they don't like Nazis on the compilation, and the Nazis didn't catch on. But the joke backfired, and he's been apologizing for ever since. And he's definitely not a Nazi, and it's probably not my space to say why he's not a Nazi, but he's definitely not a Nazi. But the point being is I've been listening to I got like three or four of these rare Death and Death in June is so suspect that Bandcamp, like – They banned them, even though I don't – who knows? Yeah, anyways. So anyways, I bought some Death in June CDs and some Soul Invictus CDs, and they're all like super minimalist, super haunting. It's like goth without any of the rock aspect. It's like super like heavy stuff, but not heavy like Black Sabbath. Like conceptually, it's some of the heaviest shit I've ever heard. It's so weird. Like I have no idea what they're talking about. And so when I bought them from the guy at the counter, he kind of gave me like a look. He was like, "Why are you buying this?" You know what I mean? And so, anyways, boys.
So you're now on some kind of a government watch list. Is that what you're saying?
And meanwhile, I was at the record store, and the guy working at the record store, he's like, "I'm going to destroy this record." And he had a record in his hand. I'm like, "What record is it?" And the record was, my wife ran off with a blank, a very offensive word, you know. And he's like, "I'm going to destroy this." I'm like, well, and I'm like, don't destroy it. Like maybe it's like Blowfly or a comedy record or Richard Pryor. And he's like, well, you can have it if you want it. I'm going to destroy it. And being a student of history, I'm like, well, even if something's offensive, you should destroy it. It's important to keep it to record history, you know? And so he gave it to me, but I think he thought I was being suspect. And so it's been a very suspect couple of weeks for
what
John.
What was the name of that artist?
Oh, the N-word artist?
Yes.
I don't even know.
Is it Johnny Rebel?
No.
It wasn't David Allan Coe.
No, I actually Googled the record. I couldn't find anything about it. It wasn't like one of those guys, you know?
It was just like only sold at truck stops.
It was like this weird-ass record from like the 50s or 60s. Mm. And I thought, oh, maybe it's like a comedy record or maybe it's like Blowfly. But it was not. It was not so at all.
Did you destroy the record?
Well, no, I haven't because actually it's worth like $300. I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do with it. You know?
Now, if you go to sell it, and the person who wants to buy it from you clearly thinks of it as a serious recording, do you still sell it to them?
Well, that's the question. You know, what do I do with it? You know what I mean? I mean, I don't know. But the point being is, boys,
that guy was like on the Lawrence Welk show in the '50s. You watch, he's like a mainstream artist.
The point being, boys, is don't let me get sucked up in this esoterica with this Death in June stuff and this Soul Invictus stuff. If I come out on the podcast and start saying whacked out stuff, Adam and Tom, I'm going to need you guys to pull me back to the light. I'm telling you.
Eh. John, I personally would enjoy watching you melt down, John, so I'm going to go ahead and let you go all the way in.
This is a sign that you have too much time on your hands, I think. Where
what, listen to Death in June?
Yeah, just there, you know, if you were just a smidge busier, like let's say you got a side gig cutting lawns or something, right? You're out there cutting lawns, then you don't have any time to traffic in potentially Nazi, but maybe not memorabilia, and then you know you keep your credit history and your reputation on the internet clean. And
John will become the guy who's explained to everybody that the swastika was around way before the Nazis. And
yeah, you don't want to be that guy.
Well, I'm just saying, I am kind of tired of bands that like say XYZ. I'm enjoying bands where they're total aliens, you know what I mean? And I don't think the guy, I mean, I don't know how you can be gay and be a Nazi, you know?
I mean, I don't yeah, know. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, you certainly would have to ignore certain tenets of it.
I couldn't say what gets you in or out of that club. It is beyond my knowledge. But
Google it, Adam.
Yeah, John. I think that the problem here is that this is going to start to creep into your search history. Actually, the real problem is that you are going to innocently look up one of these things on the internet, and then Google's stupid YouTube algorithm is going to really quickly be like, oh, so you like this Death in June song, eh? What about this, right? And right. Serves you up something. And then, you know, you walk away from your computer to get a drink, and you come back, and all of a sudden it's like six levels deeper into the YouTube shit pile.
All of a sudden, Google thinks that you're a Holocaust denier.
Yeah, like
because you went to get a drink and you left your YouTube running.
There's pattern recognition software, John, right now that is looking at you. It's probably some, you know, Alexa thing that's listening to this podcast and is trying to triangulate exactly where in the spectrum you may lie.
I'm so glad you used my real name on the podcast, John. I'm going to be associated with your Nazi imagery.
Jokes on them. I've only been listening to Death in June on CD and records. So, hey.
Your phone is listening.
It could be.
Probably is. John, here is a serious question out of all this. At what point does like self-caution stop you from going down one of these roads?
Well, isn't that the question? Like, my friend and I almost crashed a Scientology service once, but then we thought maybe that actually is how people get brainwashed. Like, they crash it as a joke, and then they get brainwashed. So we chickened out.
Next thing you know, you're buddies with Tom Cruise.
I know. Exactly.
Well, because I'm curious though, like where your line is, because for me, whenever I have like the easiest excuse for anything these days, which is that I don't have time for it. And I use that for totally innocent things that I'm not going to bother engaging with, which I assume you could apply the same thing to something that is problematic. But like for me, you know, one of the reasons I'm doing my whole fucking newsletter thing is because, you know, I can do it once a week and it's, you know, it's limited to the amount of bands that I'm talking about because I have this, you know, geographic restriction in which I'm talking about Canadian stuff, right? So there are times where all of a sudden I will get a PR email and I'll start reading through it and I'm like, oh God, there's a lot of stuff in here. What are these guys talking about? Do I need to go sit down and really listen to this? And then I'm like, and then it says, you know, the band is from New Jersey. And I'm like, yes. And then I delete the email and just move on with my life because I'm like, there you go. Self-selected. That's one less thing that I don't have to think about right now because I can't. I don't have time. Now that same self-preservation mechanism would probably stop me from really engaging with, you know, some artist of potentially like historic problematic nature at about the second that I learned that, like, there was, you know, that this is a thing that could somehow come back and bite me in the ass. Because I would look at it and go, like, oh, you know what? I have very little time to do anything anyways. I'm not going to waste it on this thing that may or may not be a Nazi thing. But what's your limit? What stops you at some point? What scares you off?
Two things. First of all, is I do feel as though current society is very dark age thinking, and that if you don't say this or you do say this, that then you're good or you're bad, and you must say this script or else you're bad. I don't ever want to engage in that. You know what I mean? I'm confident in myself that I have the power of critical thinking, and I can interpret things and make my mind up about something without someone having to say I am good or I am bad to me. I like to give myself. I hope I'm smarter than that. The second thing is I don't actually. I mean, I could be wrong. I don't think he's a Nazi. I mean, I've read the lyrics pretty closely. I've listened to the music, and there's nothing there that I can find that actually means he's a Nazi. There's people that have like these theories about it. Say, well, when he says X, he actually means Y. But I can't find any actual evidence that suggests that. You know what I mean? So that's my line, if you will. You know.
I just keep looking at these things these days like it's like there's this zero-sum game as far as, you know, how many slots of free mental time in a day where I can put towards something. And let's say I have...
How many slots in a day do you have towards using your own critical thinking? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. No, I have four.
He wastes most of his energy at his job that pays his bills, probably.
Right. So I have four slots in the day which I can devote to something that is not work or kids or nominally paying attention to my wife, right? So if I have
a little too much, honest there, Adam.
So if I have four slots, right? Well, what am I going to do with them? And I figure like the second that I stumble across something,
if Adam wants to have marital relations that night, then he's only got three slots because he has to waste one of his slots being nice to his wife. Yeah, exactly.
But this is why it takes.
This is why we don't let our wives listen to the podcast, Adam.
This is why it takes us like literally months to watch a season of a TV show because you know we'll sit down and we'll watch like. Like an episode of something, maybe two a week. And, you know, every time I hear like people on the internet talking about like, just like things that they're binging, be it TV or anything else. I'm like, you assholes. I don't believe that you actually exist. People were, you know, be like, oh, this new season of Stranger Things came out. We watched all of it yesterday. And I'm like, no, you didn't. How? Or I don't know. Like there's young people I know that are in the music world that have decided that all of a sudden they're going to really be into REM for some reason. Right. And which fine. I don't have any problem with that, but clearly like, you know, these people are like 25. Clearly they went and they listened to like the entire REM catalog in the past, you know, 48 hours and have rendered judgment on which of it they like and don't like. And I'm just like what strange, like, time vortex do you all have access to that I don't? Because I have four slots. I can't fit all that into those slots.
Well,
my slots vary from day to day. Sometimes I have four, sometimes I have six, sometimes I have zero.
Well, the point being, though, Ed, is I'm not going to like limit my artistic growth, you know what I mean, or my artistic understanding. You know,
well, no, but just like given that, like, let's say you're me, given that you only have those four slots, if you start down a road and you're like, oh, man, I might potentially burn a slot on someone that may or may not be a Nazi. Do you just like veer off and be like, I'm going to go watch this TV show I've been meaning to watch instead of engaging.
The answer is I'd rather use my slots on something intellectually stimulating and or challenging than watching, you know, Jeopardy, even though I like Jeopardy or I like Stranger. Here's the answer. I like Stranger Things a lot, but if I can only make an informed choice on myself on Death in June, which is totally whacked out bizarre art, or Stranger Things, which is enjoyable and well done, but, you know, safe, I'm probably going to take the thing that's going to challenge me, to tell you the truth.
Even if the thing that's going to challenge you, you may, and you know this at the start, you may end up in the Reich.
Well, that's why I'm calling you two to pull me out. If I, you know, if it gets too dangerous, I'm going to need you two to put on like headbands. You know, like Tom will be like chopping woods off in a cabin, and Adam will come up, and Tom will be like, well, look who it is. And then Adam will be like, Tom, it's time. And Tom will be like, I've retired from that life. I'm here with my wife and kids now. And then Adam will be like, but John needs us. And then you guys will band together to rescue me from the grip of death in June. Anyways, let's play a song.
It's like it's like John, here's a sandwich you've never eaten before. There might, very well might, be a scorpion in it. Or there's this thing that we can guarantee you does not have a scorpion in it. You're like, well, you know, I gotta satisfy my intellectual curiosity.
But life is all about the adrenaline rush you get for eating the sandwich that might have a scorpion in it, Adam. I'm with John on this.
There you go. Listen, well, who's got a song, and we'll come back and we'll hit the news?
I have a song by a band that has no affiliations with Nazis, unlike the stuff John likes.
I'll tell you, they don't have affiliation with Nazis.
Just kidding. I actually played a song off this, a couple weeks back, but my pals over at Billy Records and Tapes are putting out a Ringworm Childbite split. So let's play the new Childbite song that just got premiered this week. It is called The Masochist. And this is going to be from the Split Hits the Fans Volume 5 with Ringworm Childbite. This is The Masochist.
That was Childbite. Interestingly, Tom did refer to Ringworm in reference to what we were talking to earlier, and one could make a connection, and we'll leave it at that. Speaking of connections, a long-lost Lemmy Linda duet has been released. Of course, Lemmy Kilmister passed away about 3 years ago now, I think. But apparently in the late 70s, he recorded a duet with Linda Kay, famous country singer, and it's going to get released.
Is she a famous country singer?
Yeah, I mean, country-wise, she's very big.
Is she really? Why did I never hear of her then?
I mean,
she's not freaking Loretta Lynn or Dolly Parton or something.
She's kind of close. I mean, she's Linda Kay.
Oh, come on.
Linda Kay is a very famous country western singer, Tom.
No, I'm here. I just lost you there. No, I just, okay, I'll take your word for it, I guess.
She was also in Petticoat Junction, apparently. I didn't even know that.
Oh, okay. Well, I remember vaguely watching that in reruns when I was like a small child, which means you guys were, your fathers probably weren't even old enough to generate sperm yet.
She was also in Sliders, in case you watched 96, 90s.
Yeah. No kidding. Anyway, maybe I'm underestimating Linda Kay. I'm sorry.
Well, you're not the first. Anyways, Linda Kay, she's releasing a new album. It's called Black and Gold. It's a double disc release. And on it, it's got a long-lost Lemmy duet. And Lemmy's vocals, I think, were recorded in like 1979 or so. And they just finished it now. And what'd you guys think? And is this an unfair digging into Lemmy's corpse? Or is this nice and good and we're glad that it came out?
The song is perfectly nice. So like audibly, it's not corpse digging. Like it sounds like the kind of thing that, you know, from a sonic standpoint, you know, absolutely should be out there in the world. Is it a cash grab? I don't know. Are the throngs of grieving Motorhead fans gonna rush out and grab a country record?
Maybe
they might buy it on like a whatever service you can buy a song on now, iTunes or whatever. That would be my thing. I probably wouldn't go buy the double album.
Given the amount of weird shit that has been merchandised in Motorhead's name, you know, living, you know, before or after Lemmy's death, I think that this is probably the most chaste of them. So it's fine.
So do you think Linda Kay ever tried the Motorhead magic wand that had like the war pig tip on it?
I will not besmirch Linda Kay's.
She's got to be in her 60s.
Person
now, right?
with that question. But yeah, like, you know,
listen, given the Motorhead vibrator was a brilliant piece of marketing.
It was, but given that that shit exists in the world, you know, I'm not going to get too bent out of shape about it. A legitimate song of, you know, historic note.
It might speak to the fact that we're getting old. I like this song too. I thought Lemmy's voice sounded surprisingly weak. Kind of like his last album he did where it was just sort of like thin. But yeah, it's a cool country song. You know, Lemmy would do just about anything back in the day, and this is an example of that. And he's gone now. He's not going to make anything new, and I hope there's 50 more songs that we haven't heard by him that come out.
As a side note, isn't this PR photo the second coolest PR photo ever? I mean, it's not even like that. It's just the guys in Motorhead, and they look badass.
Yeah, they look like a biker gang always. I don't really know what photo you're talking about specifically. I'll look it up.
Well, speaking of things coming out, let's see here. Nightbirds, they're recording a new album. I consider the last album an album, but I guess the band isn't really considering it an album now. So they're working on their, quote, fourth album now. They stated, 10 years ago today, Nightbirds played our first show. Thanks for caring about our band. We genuinely appreciate your fine taste in music. To celebrate this joyous occasion, we will be spending this weekend at our Maryland headquarters watching wrestling and demoing 8 new songs. What we plan will be the first stage of work towards a proper fourth album. And so people are – it seems like the commenters are excited. But here's the question, and it's a question that maybe Off faces and maybe some other bands. Is there anything left for Nightbirds to do?
Nightbirds could go and put out a tight little competent rock and roll record that you know, does their kind of – you know, Dead Kennedys vibing surf punky thing, you know, in a way that isn't going to innovate anything, but is perfectly good. And I would be happy with that. There's a certain stripe of band that I don't feel like they're setting out to innovate anything. And I'm okay that they're not. I'm more worried about them sounding flabby. So as long as that's not the case and they can do it with some fire in their belly and some, you know, fucking pep in their step, then I'm totally cool with it. Now, see, I was not a particular fan of Roll Credits, if for no reason, then it just, I guess I like that they're not really saying it is their fourth album, just because like it felt like an unfocused thing to me. Like it never struck me as a record proper in the way that I need to, you know, sit up and pay a lot of attention to it. Particularly not like something like Mutiny at Muscle Beach did. So, I mean, I'm down for them to go, you know, do a proper fourth album.
All the time speak with Adam, I really have to disagree. I thought Roll Credits was their best album. I loved how compact it was, how it sort of had a theme, 2 instrumentals, 1 cover, 5 original with vocals. It got in. I think some of those songs are some of the best songs ever. I thought it was focused, compact, and kind of was the summation of everything they do.
You think it was focused, though? Like, to me, it was just like
It felt like a collection.
Yeah, it was an odds and sods, right? Like there was nothing on there that was junk. It was just there was something about it, and I can't even really put my finger on what it was, but there's something about it that didn't feel like, to me, that it was a singular artistic
statement.
John, are you
familiar with the Fresh Kills Volume 1 album they did?
Tom, I actually got that for $5 because I saw the Nightbirds.
I know, because you talked some old man down who was trying to make a living selling records. We did it. But no, that's what that felt like to me, but a little longer. But there were a couple of, I don't know, I like the record. But, oh, by the way, you're both wrong. Born to Die in Suburbia is their best record. But I'm always up for some new Nightbirds. You know, the scary thing, we're talking about how I tend to like the older bands. You know, Nightbirds would be a band that I would give an example of a newer band I like. Meanwhile, they just celebrated 10 years, you know. So.
But I think that John's question about innovation here is interesting, because I'm curious where the line is, because so earlier in our totally unfocused intro to this episode, I besmirched the new Bad Religion record, and I was commenting that, like, to me it felt
safe.
Like, it felt
the worst thing you can say about a new punk record is that it feels safe.
Right, but then earlier today, I was at the office and I was listening to the new.
You know, it doesn't feel safe, Tom. Death in June. Yeah. It's not.
But, you know, I was listening to.
I googled them, John. They're called a neo folk band. I'm like, I'm out.
You're like, you never know what's on the other end of the word neo. You kind of want to back away from that. No, but
yeah. Anytime I see a weird stick figure thing now, I think they're going to be doing some sacrifices or something.
Okay, back to my amazing point here is that. So I was at the office earlier today, and I was listening to the new record from the Steve Adamic band, which came out earlier on Dirt Nap, called Gratitude. Is that the name of this one? I'm not totally sure, but in any case, but like the Steve Adamic band's been around for a decade, and they've put out like a whole bunch of records that pretty much all sort of sound the same. But I listened to their new record, and I'm just like, yeah, this is fun. This is just charging along, and I'm into it, and I'm all pumped up and happy. And then I go listen to the new Bad Religion record, and like, not for lack of trying, like they're trying to make, you know, Bad Religion punk rock songs.
But we're talking about closer to 40 years,
I guess, but
as
like,
opposed to 10. Plus, the other problem with the Bad Religions of the world and the NoFX and everybody else, they have too much studio budget.
I think that might be it.
They don't go in there and bang out the songs. You know, you think on the first Adolescence record or the first Suicidal Tendencies record or the Dead Boys Young, Loud, and Snotty, you think they sat there and micromanaged every second of every note and auto-tuned the vocals and all that? No way, man. They went and knocked it out. And that's what's lacking from the modern punk record. There's no spontaneity. There's no energy. Play this song 5,000 times. We'll take the best little part of each and stitch it together.
No, and I think that that's exactly nails it, right? So
the Nightbirds don't feel like that to me yet.
Right. So if the next Nightbirds record is, you know, just another Nightbirds record, but on the same quality level as you know, Muscle Beach or Born to Die in Suburbia, then that's fine. In the same way that, like,
or even fine, even The Other Side of Darkness.
But no, but in the same way that this Adamic band record came out, and I'm like, you know what? If they release another one of these in 4 months, and it kind of sounds the same, but you know, but it's recorded with sort of the same amount of you know, of
raw spontaneity, or whatever.
If it's recorded in the same shitty tin can that they've recorded everything else in, that's kind of what I want out of my.
But is that it, Adam, or is it highly technically recorded, and then they put like some kind of a weird filter program on it that makes it sound old timey?
Well, maybe, but give that old timey filter to Mr. Brett, and I would be more interested in that Bad Religion record.
The Bad Religion album isn't horrible, so I hate to.
No, it's not. But
there's a couple of songs that are genuinely bad.
It's true.
But for the most part, it's decent. But yeah, the vocal, everything is too process sounding.
It is troubling me because they are an important band in my universe. And the worst thing for me is to not like something for a reason that I can't peg. Because then it feels just like I'm drifting away from it, right? Like it's just like it feels like I've aged out of it or something. And that to me is like the shittiest feeling. Like I'm totally down with not liking, you know, No Substance, because it is a bad, bad Religion record, right? Yeah. And I can listen to it and I can go, this sucks. And the band was not in a good place and they were not writing good stuff at the time. And they were not like the circumstances around it sucked. And this was not the band at their best. And like, I can listen to that and I can click clicks for me about why I don't like it. And I kind of get the impression that, you know what, the band probably doesn't like this too much either. And oh. I get it. We're all on the same page on that one. But I listen to like Age of Unreason and I'm just like, I don't know. And my where my mind goes is is this for kids? Like have I somehow matured away from this? At like 37, like have I matured away from my being into like teenage punk rock or something, or is this just bad? And it doesn't strike me as bad, so I don't know what it is, and it's bothering me. So, but back to Nightbirds, like I don't think they're going to do that. But John, to your initial question, there, do they need to do that? Like if they went and they. It's like you said you really liked Roll Credits. If they released something that sort of had the same general sound and vibe of Roll Credits, it was Roll Credits Part Deux. Are you cool with that, or do you need them to veer?
Well, we're going to talk about Ceremony later on. That's the question, you know. And for me, I guess my personal preference is veer a little bit, but don't veer too much. I think Effed Up actually handled it pretty well. I think. Effed Up is one of the more interesting punk bands that has continued to evolve but remain punk. That being said, if they turn in Roll Credits Part Two, I dig it. I like it a lot, you know. But on the other hand, there's only so many times you can do that. You know, there's a reason why people don't care about, I don't know, trying to think of a band that's put up, like DOA's. Like, does anyone care about any DOA album from like after 1985? Not really. It's because
they're not bad, though. But they're not bad.
They're all good, but like they're all kind of like
a couple years ago. I reviewed it; was really solid. But yeah, I didn't go back to it.
Are you cranking it now? You know what I mean? Like, are you going back? Because I'm still going back to Roll Credits.
Are you cranking? Well, but but the thing is, there's nothing wrong with doing one thing and doing it really well.
But it gets boring. I mean, does anybody care?
It gets boring. But you know, AC/DC has been telling the same dick joke for 45 years, and they still fill hockey rinks.
But it's still boring. I mean, it's boring. You know what I mean? But
yeah.
Well, how about Motor? I mean, Motorhead is awesome.
Motorhead's later records were great.
Yeah, but no one listens to them.
Last one was good. The last studio album was good.
Listen, if I'm going to spend my time listening to like a later date Motorhead record or, you know, some whacked out record. It's going to be
Overkill or Ace of Spades. I know.
You know, I mean, like, actually my favorite is Orgasmatron. I love that album.
Really?
I love Orgasmatron.
Interesting.
The only Motorhead album where there are four piece, I believe.
John, why didn't they name their vibrator Orgasmatron? It was such a natural fit for marketing purposes.
Maybe it was too on point. Maybe they wanted something a little bit more. What's the word I'm looking for? Not subtle. Something more subtle.
Oh yeah, that's what Motorhead's known for. Their subtlety. I mean, they're second only to the Misfits for.
It's probably because the Orgasmatron trademark is now owned by the Hasbro Corporation. So
oh, it could be.
Yeah, they're not allowed to use it.
That'd be great. They could make a kid's product, you know, because you're never too young to introduce the kids to sex toys.
We're making this episode real edgy. Let's bring it back from the edge. Adam, let's talk about Chain Whip, who actually used the same imagery as Death in June. No lie. They use the same imagery. So Chain Whip, Adam, what's the deal? What should we be checking out? Should we be digging this new track by Chain Whip?
Everyone should be digging Chain Whip. Chain Whip is fun. Chain Whip is one of these bands where everyone who's among their principal songwriters are huge archival punk nerds. And I say that in the most loving way possible. So it's a four piece out of Vancouver. The vocalist in the band is Josh Nickel, who plays in, played in Fashionism, who just broke up. Fashionism, they're one of these bands that you'd recognize the vocalist because he's been in 20 other Vancouver area punk bands at some point over the years. So you may have heard like in the late 90s, I think it was the late 90s when like the Newtown Animals had their record come out, and then he had a solo thing called Jeffy Genetic and His Clones. And then he had a band called The Transmitters. And I'm sure there's like 12 other of them. So anyways, so that was Fashionism. They were one of these bands that was like a total staple on sort of the Pacific Northwest punk scene. But anyways, though, so Josh played in them, but he also runs a label called Neon Taste or Neon Waste. He has a label and a blog, and one of them is Neon Taste and one of them is Neon Waste, and I'm blanking on which is which. Let's see. What does it say? It doesn't say. I'm not looking at it. Anyways, but what the Neon Asterix projects do is they've been just issuing like a ton of records from all these small but like really like classically minded hardcore and oi and just gritty punk rock bands that have been coming out of Vancouver. And then on the other end of it, on drums, you've got Pat Bertrand, who plays in a band called Corner Boys, but for the longest time he ran Hosehead Records, which is another one of these labels that, and Hosehead more than Neon Taste even, did just tons of archival material. Like they went out and they found bands that were like contemporaries to DOA, say back in like 1976, 77, bands like... Like from the era with like the pointed sticks were around and stuff like that. And they would have been putting out a lot of that material. So both these guys are just completely in love with punk rock from a late 70s standpoint, but not from a cliched read on it. Right. Like they're not guys that are, you know, trying to recreate the Clash or Sex Pistols or something, you know, time and time and time again. They were into all these like little weird bands that were around then. So you get the two of them together and you put them in a band, and you get some guys that are in a bunch of other like pretty quality punk bands, and they've gone and they've cranked out this really killer hardcore record that, like, and like hardcore in the 70s, the late 70s, you know, at its earliest point sense of things. And it never sounds nostalgic because the whole time they're just going at like 90 miles an hour. Like it's great. So so anyways, Chain Whip, it's a band that you guys should go listen to. The record is out on August 31st, which is Friday or Saturday from whenever now is and we're recording. It's called 14 Lashes. They're self-releasing it in North America at least. And it's one of those bands where I listen to and it all my cynicism shakes away and I'm just like, yay, punk rock. Punk rock is great. So yeah. That's my sell for Chain Whip.
Well, in contrast to things that aren't so great, Blink-182, they've released people are calling it a mashup, but it's not really a mashup. It's a re-recording. It's What's My Age Again and Lil Wayne's A Millie mixed together, a new version. And that's because they're on tour together, Blink-182 and Lil Wayne. And I got to say, man, I mean, I know we were talking about Blink-182 last week or 2 weeks ago, but I don't know how anyone can say Blink-182 is or ever was punk or how they represent the punk culture in any respect. And why are we even talking about this band at all?
Because you scheduled the story.
But see, when,
like, John, the gatekeeper.
Whenever we post Chain Whip or whatever, people are like, this is stupid, you know, or you guys only post about the stuff you want. And then we post Blink-182 and Lil Wayne, and people are like, I want to like this, but I can't. It's like, why? Like, this is garbage.
I'll take it one step further. I refuse to listen to it. So
this is
life's too short. Life's too short for that 4 minutes.
See, life's too short. This is my slots argument, right?
I'm talking. I might only have 4 slots left till I die, Adam.
Well, yeah. So
I'm not giving one to freaking Blink-182 and Lil Wayne.
Right. So yeah. So
meanwhile, I just spent like a half hour on YouTube listening to Wesley Willis.
that's a good use of your time. So I yeah. This is a dumb remix. There is a part of my reptile brain that will hear the chorus for What's My Age Again, and for a brief few seconds, I'm 16, and I get the nostalgia there, but yeah, but then I don't know, like this is something about like this when it is like this isn't a re-recording of the song. It's not like they went into the studio and collaborated on it, right? It is pretty much a like lifted the audio of Blink from, you know, 1998 or whenever they recorded that record, and just dropped it into this, which just seems like it seems cynical. Like it's I don't want to say cash grab because I don't know who's paying any money for it, right? It just seems like a, I don't know, a not great use of anyone's time to go put it together. And that isn't even a I'm not coming at this from like some sort of, you know, I'm a rock and roll person, anti-rap argument or anything like that. It's just, it doesn't do any of either artist a particular service to make this thing. So I know it's maybe it sells ads on YouTube or something like that. But I mean, if we're talking about Blink, did anyone watch the video for the new song that they released today?
Adam, I only have 4 slots.
Yeah. Mm. So,
and I chose to fill that slot punching myself in the face instead of watching the new Blink-182 video.
Well, see, that was my reaction to it, especially given the context to it, because the byline in the article was like, Blink releases new song that features a bunch of kids doing dances from Fortnite. And I'm like, that combines 2 things that I know very little about.
Turn the sound down, be better.
Right? Like I don't understand what a Fortnite is, except that it's a video game, and I haven't listened to a new Blink record in a decade. So I mean I don't know why I need to bother with this. But then John said, well, we should talk about Blink on the show. So I went and I did it, guys. I went and I watched this video. And I don't know, like the kids look like they're having fun. I mean, I actually, given that I'm very hesitant to talk too much about Blink-182 on this show because A, I know nothing about them, and B, the last time I talked about Blink-182 on this show, and I mentioned that podcast that shall not be named. People tweeted me and then tweeted the podcast. And then all of their zealots started sending me memes all day long. So I don't want to raise the ire of that whole universe again. But I don't know, like I go and I listen to this new Blink song that they released, and it feels like if I were in their position, I might be writing songs like that, where it's kind of new wavy. It's not really new wavy in a way that's particularly interesting. It achieves its new waveness less through fun synthesizer usage and more from some studio vocal effect crap. But I feel that, like, if I was that band and I'm like, oh, I don't want to sing dick joke songs anymore over 4-chord punk, you know, I could see veering into the new wave universe, right? Like I get that, but I don't have any context for how culturally significant this music video is, and I don't want to. It's a bunch of kids doing like weird thrusting dances. And they all look, I mean, the kids are adorable and they all look super pleased with themselves to be in this music video, and good for them. But I feel that I'm not supposed to be looking at this video going, aw, kids are great, which is my dad opinion looking at the video. I'm supposed to look at this video and be like, yeah, video games or something. I don't know. How does gamer culture get excited about things? And I don't know their nomenclature.
All I know is Off couldn't even get, what was it, like $70,000 to film a movie, and these guys get $70,000 to film a stupid music video that's terrible. There's no justice in this world.
I mean, it's It's a well choreographed music video. I mean, kudos to the director. I don't get it. I mean, again, you want to talk about like things that seem cynical. It seems cynical to take your pop punk band that is full of 40-year-olds and to make it relevant again with the kids by incorporating the video game that is currently popular with 9-year-olds or whoever the fuck plays Fortnite. And I don't know, that to me seems cynical. Like that is That's my noise. That's what I'm gonna make.
Well, it's boring. I don't know how Blink-182 got involved in the punk scene to begin with, and I sure don't know why we're still talking about them.
Because I mean, you scheduled the story, John.
Adam, you're saying you want me to be a cultural fascist and only talk about and only post things that we think are interesting and not post what the general populace thinks is interesting.
John, I'm saying we got 4 fucking slots, and you just filled one of them with Blink-182.
Well, we got 4 more slots. We're running a little low, so let's play a song, and we'll hit the rest of the slots going pretty quickly. Who should play the song next?
Sure. Okay, so this is a band called Plastic Heads. It is a bunch of guys from a bunch of other bands that I like. It features Matthew Ellis from the Hamilton psych rock punk band Flesh Rag, John Sharon, who's played in Career Suicide and Brutal Nights. Their bassist Eric plays in a band called FLQ, and he's played in a band called Hassler and the School Jerks. And then their drummer Curtis Tone is 1/3 of the lineup of School Damage. So these are a bunch of guys that play in a bunch of Ontario punk rock bands that are all pretty good and pretty fun. And they've got together, they created a band called Plastic Heads that plays pretty much straight out of the late 70s. You know, just straight up punk rock. That's just super, super enjoyable on that level. They recorded a 10-song debut record called Nowhere to Run. They recorded with Jimmy Vapid from the band The Vapids, producing, not the US Vapids that are related to Dan Vapid, but this is a Canadian Vapids, but anyways. The record came out in, I don't know, when was it? When was it, Adam's newsletter? February? It came out in February of this year, and it's fun. It's good. So this is Plastic Heads. I'm going to play a song called... Give me a second to find out what the song is called. The End is Near. So this is Plastic Heads from the album Nowhere to Run. And it's a punk rock record. Here you go.
And that was Plastic Heads. We got a couple of stories we're going to blast on through. Speaking of artists recording with children, or playing with children. Gibby Haynes of the Butthole Surfers is doing a set where it's going to be backed by kids, and they're doing all Butthole Surfer tracks. It's through the Paul Green Rock Academy, which it's kids about 13 to 16, I'd say, and they play a pretty extended set, almost 2 hours of all Butthole Surfer classics, and Gibby sings. And I actually saw this in Philadelphia, and it's really cool. It's very noisy and very messy, but honestly, like, the Butthole Surfers is the perfect band for that because they're a noisy, messy band.
I was going to say, how does he get that much LSD for all those kids?
it's funny how, like, some of these really whacked out artists sometimes seem more charming with kids, and you're like, oh, he's not a danger to the kids. And I mean, he's not, you know what I mean? Like Gibby Haynes is a wild, wild guy, but I think he can restrain himself when he's around children. And, you know,
there's a fascinating podcast, and I can't remember what it was. Somebody sent it to me about a kind of an oral history of the Butthole Surfers. And it was fascinating. Those guys were weird, and the path they forged and their sort of independent spirit. Cool band, man. Cool band.
And I think it's cool that he's down to do these wacky kind of things. I mean, I was there. I can't imagine he's getting that much money out of it. You know what I mean? Like, it was maybe like 80 people there, $10 a ticket, $800. Even if that all goes to Gibby, which I'm sure it doesn't, there's not that much money there, you know? And it's a lot of work, I'm sure, you know, but it's really cool. I had two concerns with this, and I don't know if you guys have. Tom, you'd probably be the most likely to be able to weigh in on this. First, a lot of F-words going around. I didn't approve of the F-words going around 13, 14, 15-year-olds, and not Gibby, mind you, other people, you know? Also, the kids were 13.
Oh, are you talking about, like, the audience?
I'm trying – I guess Gibby said the F word here or there, but like the audience and yeah. Other thing is the kids were 13, 14, 15, little skimpy clothes, I thought. You know, it's like that's not all rock and roll is, you know, like some of the kids were dressed up, you know, like not Darby Crash, lead singer of Dead Boys, Stiv Bader, like, you know, the boys were dressed up like Stiv Baders.
Old man Gentile's like, I don't approve of you kids trying to look all punk rock.
You know, there's plenty of time to be grown up. The point being is this, is the kids were dressed pretty skimpy, boys and girls. I don't know if I approved of that. But you know, you can be yourself. You don't have to dress like Stiv Baders. You don't have to dress like... Well, I mean, honestly, a lot of the early punk rock women didn't really dress that skimpy at all, you know.
No, Belinda Carlisle, one of the original LA punks, was famous for making long dresses out of garbage bags.
Or look at Joan Jett. Like, they
dressed like a 50s noir kind of style.
But all the girls were kind of in like Catholic schoolgirl outfits and that kind of. I a little skimpy for me. I don't know.
Yeah, it is a little disturbing when you see like sexualized 13 to 15 year olds.
Yeah. You agree with me then.
I mean, I sort of do. I remember going to the last couple of times my daughter and I went to Riot Fest. It was just like, yeah, you see young girls, teenage girls walking around in their bras or whatnot. And it was hot. I get it. I mean, wear whatever you want. But there's this sort of paradox where it's like, don't sexualize me. Don't sexualize me. And then they sort of dress in a way that would kind of tell a different story. And I'm not saying that dressing gives me the right to sexualize someone, but it certainly seems like a mixed message, doesn't it?
Well,
maybe, you can't sell it. You can't sell it and say don't buy it at the same time.
Well, I'm saying there's parents there, and the guy running the thing is an adult. I mean, you can't blame Gibby because he's just a hired talent. You know, like he's not like, I should do this. You know, they said, Gibby, will you come do this? Right. So the guy running it, like, it's like, how come none of the parents are like, yo, bro, you know, why is my daughter who's 14 like showing him like a lot of cleavage and has got like really short skirts? Or maybe they all dress that way these days and that's just how it is. I don't know. I know girls my age, girls, you know, girls 25 don't dress that skimpy, so why are 14-year-olds dressing that skimpy? It seems wrong to me. I don't know. Adam, you have any input on that? Or
I'm gonna try to sound really woke here and ignore the fact that I'm gonna have to confront this when my daughter is slightly older than what she is. So in my blissful ignorance right now, I'm going to say the girls can probably have the agency to do whatever they want here. And
at 14?
Yeah, they have the agency to do what they want. It's not my place to sit here and tell them what they
– That's the politically correct answer. But like I said, I've been fighting with this for a few years already, Adam, and it's right. the struggle is real, man.
I don't have to
– Isn't that the job of the dad, or even more so the mom? Like, isn't it kind of like the mom's job to say, listen, like, you don't have to do that, you know?
I'm going to say that, like, right now, like, my major problem with, like, my 6-year-old is that she leaves the house wearing pants and not, you know, not what levels of hemline or whatever are involved.
She wears pants and not skirts, like is required of our religious sect.
Yes, no, I meant pants at all. Because you know, it's like young kids are crazy because like they have no conception of like when they should or shouldn't be naked sometimes, and it's at some point
it's like grown people when they're on LSD hanging out with Gabby
Hayes. Yeah. So, but yeah, I'm gonna play the woke one here and say that like the girls have the agency to do what they want, and regardless of what they do, you know, it's also the responsibility of the Tom Traumas of the world to fucking keep their shit in check. Now,
absolutely, I would never argue otherwise.
Now, will I have a much more jaded...
And I resent the implication that I have trouble doing that.
Well, I have a much different opinion on this God, I don't know, like
10 years,
3 to 4 years. Who knows? I don't know when it happens.
About 14 is when it gets really bad, even though when they're younger, like my younger one's 12 and it's already because she has an older sister and she's got, you know, she's the youngest. So
in any case, that is a problem for future Adam to deal with. Current Adam is really cool.
Well, enjoy that sand in your ears from having your head stuck in the ground there, Adam.
Yes.
Tom, not to drag this out, but do kids dress skimpier now than when we were like 14 or 15?
So I grew up in the 80s, dude. Every girl when I was growing up looked like they were in the Taliban. It was, you know, turtleneck sweaters and long sleeves. And I remember definitely thinking that 10 or 15 years later, like the high school girls dress much skimpier. But like my kids, they go to a public high school and there's a stricter dress code than when we went, honestly. They, you know, no spaghetti straps, no this, no that. So I don't know. I only go to like old man shows and stuff, so I don't really see that many kids.
John, you're really trying to train this Amazon robot to think you are like the weirdest person.
John's pretty much Taliban.
It's just like, well, it's just
men
like
men can't control themselves. Women need to be covered at all times. No, I'm just giving
it's like right now the robot is like John Gentile and it's writing bullet points and it's like
Nazi
question mark. It's like, are children too sexy? Question mark. I'm just like,
Google that. Are children too sexy?
While we're in, let's talk about murder. So of course, Death Row Records is one of the most infamous and famous record labels of the 90s. Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg, Tupac, Warren G, the Lady of Rage. The list goes on and on. One of the forefronts of G-funk and gangster rap, and of course, at the very center of the East Coast West Coast feuds, along with Biggie Smalls on the East Coast. And of course, it was run by Suge Knight, probably the most infamous record label ever, or at least in, you know, the Western Hemisphere. He, of course, founded Death Row and went bankrupt in, I think it was like 2005 or 2001, around there, and he lost control of the label after that happened. Since then, the label's been shuffled around back and forth, and they've got a new owner, and the new owner of Death Row Records, including Dr. Dre's famous album, The Chronic, Snoop Dogg's Doggy Style, is, of course, Hasbro Toys. And not only does Hasbro Toys own Death Row Records, they also own music by High on Fire, Lemmy of Motorhead, Madness. And that's because they bought basically the entire assets of E1 Entertainment, which is a multi-international a media company. They've got movies, they got music, they got TV shows. The real reason Hasbro bought it is because they own The Walking Dead and Peppa Pig, at least the U.S. and North American rights, which is gigantic. And so Dr. Dre is just kind of a bonus. Do you guys find this amusing? Is this amusing? Or does it just go to how unimportant music is these days and how worthless music is these days, that they bought some of the most famous music of the 90s and it's really just an afterthought that they don't even care about, and it's just a fact of life?
It's just like the corporatocracy kind of thing, you know? There's just so few big companies that own so much of this stuff. I do find it kind of amusing, but will there be backlash?
I mean, honestly, like, I don't think – I mean, like, as famous as The Chronic is, it's relatively – especially in the context of movies and TVs, it's worthless. Like, if they repress The Chronic, what are they going to make, $50,000?
sell a thousand hours, sell a thousand of them,
$200,000 to a TV production company. Like,
and it wouldn't be that much anyway. They could do a limited run of a couple thousand, maybe.
Let's say
the vinyl market's small, dude. Small.
Let's say they do 5,000 records, $20 a pop, $100,000, right? That's nothing to a movie or TV. That's like nothing. That's like their craft services budget for a week. You know, yeah. That's like nothing. So.
No, but the comment I made on is maybe we can finally get a decent Lemmy action figure now.
That's a good answer. I mean
Hasbro, man. Hasbro was the toy company of my youth. That was the Star Wars company. I believe, wasn't it? With like the 70s Star Wars characters?
Yeah, the classics. Yeah. I bury fond memory of those toys. Maybe we'll get a Suge Knight action figure. I gotta say, Suge Knight.
I want a Lemmy action figure with a lightsaber goes right into his arm and it has that little stem where you slide it out like the hole in his arm, like my classic Luke Skywalker I got for Christmas when I was 5.
Adam White, Suge Knight, personal model for you or personal model for everybody?
Oh, I mean, well, now with his guest appearance on Peppa Pig, really like role model for the children.
You East Coast guy or West Coast guy, Adam?
what's really weirded me out here is that this E1 company even existed because I was not aware of them until this.
Well, the only bands putting out new stuff on E1 are like older metal bands, it seems like, isn't it?
I'm not talking about E1 from a label standpoint. I mean them from just like a conglomerate standpoint. Where the they like and this popped up in my world because they there's a really good podcast that is run out of my former
basement
university town of
it's run out of your basement Adam
no, this is the only podcast so there's a podcast called Creative Control spelt with K's, so named after the Hot Snakes song that Vish Khanna runs out of Guelph, and they do really some of the best kind of most in-depth artist interview, like musician interview stuff that is out there these days. I mean, like Vish is an incredible broadcaster, he's a great interviewer and all this kind of stuff. And so he kind of commented on Twitter, like offhand, he's like, oh shit. Like my podcast is now my podcast network is now owned by the Peppa Pig people or whatever, or by Hasbro. And I went and I looked and I'm like, A, I didn't realize that Creative Control was part of a podcast network, or B, that Entertainment One had a podcast network, or see that Entertainment One even existed in the first place. And I'm just like, I'm digging through the pile of stuff that this company owns, and well, I guess before Hasbro bought it. And it's bonkers. It's weird. You would expect, I guess, I would expect with these big companies these days in particular, there'd be like a certain amount of hubris where they don't just like it's very 90s to me to have one of these multinational conglomerates and have no one really know what it does, right? Like these days we're in this like post cynicism world where we're all cheering it on when these conglomerates are merging. Like I can guarantee you all the comic nerds and all that in the world, we're cheering on Disney buying Fox, right? Because, hey, we all wanted, you know, the Marvel Cinematic Universe to have access to the X-Men and Fantastic Four again, right? So, you know, yeah, we may have just seen two giant entertainment companies merge and therefore lessen the amount of potential creative voices that are going to come from different sources in the universe. But hey, whatever, you know, Wolverine can meet Captain America and that's all that matters to us. So, you know, we're all cheering that shit on. You know, everyone's all pumped about the fact that, hey, now Disney can make this like giant Disney Plus, you know, Netflix thingy. And hey, it can have not only all your Marvel movies, but all your Star Wars movies and all your Simpsons and all this other stuff that they bought. Great, right? And, you know, we're all for that. So these big companies, they're all trying to get their name out there. Like they're not trying to hide and be like the shadowy owners of all this stuff. But But E1, fuck, never heard of them. So maybe that's what all this is there's going to be like a, there's going to be like the Hasbro cinematic universe, and it's going to have, you know, Suge Knight and Peppa Pig and what do they own?
I'm telling you. Zombies. Hasbro Motorhead vibrators.
I think maybe Suge Knight really is a fascinating figure. He comes from an extremely poor background. He gets a scholarship to play football. He plays football for like a season, but isn't good, so he gets fired. So he links up with a songwriter, and he threatens to sue Vanilla Ice, and he threatens to throw him off a balcony. So Vanilla Ice settles with him. Suge Knight takes that money, starts Death Row Records, puts out some of the most famous hip-hop records ever, becomes super rich, blows it all, files for bankruptcy, runs over a guy trying to get away from Dr. Dre, and now he's in jail. I mean, it's crazy how Suge Knight...
it's amazing the parallels between that and the Tom Trauma story.
The same wherewithal... The point is, like, the same wherewithal that he had to, like, build himself up is the same thing that destroyed him in the end. And he's not a good guy, but I'm just saying, it is amazing that someone could build themselves up from nothing just through sheer violence, really. You know what I mean?
It's just not, you know, it is an interesting story, but it's not that unusual story. You know, it's like the same skill set that can get you to the top is also the one that kind of brings you to your demise. You know, it's like there's sort of two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. Very, very true.
Like so many of the great artists, you know, are self-destructive.
I was thinking about the exact thing. Let's not drag this out, but yeah, I was thinking about Chuck Berry. Exactly. The reason why Chuck Berry made money and the reason why he became famous in the 60s is because as an African-American, many labels said, sell us the rights to your music. You know, we'll own it. You just play it. And he said, no, I will not sell the rights to my music. So he owns Johnny B. Goode. He owns Carol, all that stuff.
I don't think he owns anything anymore, but yeah, I get you.
Well, fair enough. You're right. I forgot about that. But anyway, the point being is
the only thing he owns now is a 6x6 foot plot, John.
So the reason Chuck Berry was able to rise above and become famous was because he had the business sense to basically make his own decisions and not trust shady managers, not trust shady accounts, because he would. How many African American poor artists got ripped off in the 50s and 60s because people took advantage of them? Chuck Berry,
even the 60s, 70s. You know, Jimi Hendrix never had any money. He died poor.
So Chuck Berry had that wherewithal. However, once he became famous, he was kind of stuck in that mindset because that's what enabled him to survive. And so he would do like shady, like his guarantee would be $4,000. He'd get there and say, I want $6,000 or I'm not playing. And, you know, promoters knew that he would ask for an extra $1,000 or $2,000 so they'd have it ready. So that kind of that.
And he just drove from gig to gig in his car with his guitar and used pickup bands and did some things that would never allow him to get to that next level.
Exactly. But he would have never gotten to where he was if he didn't have that mindset. But that's what trapped him as well. So fascinating, you know?
Yeah.
Well, speaking of something that's going to be huge, filmmaker Chad Stockflesh, has spent the last 10 years making a documentary on the Elephant Six Collective. Of course, the Elephant Records Six Collective is most famously Neutral Hotel, but also Of Montreal, Apples in Stereo, Elf Power, couple of other acts.
A lot of household names there.
Well, Neutral Milk Hotel is gigantic.
I know who they are. I've heard of them. I've heard of like two of those bands. Of Montreal, I've heard of.
He made a documentary, but the only way you get a documentary is by the following. It's finding a flyer that he put up around several towns, dialing the automated telephone line, sending in a request for the movie. They mail you a VHS tape. You watch it, and you're supposed to mail the VHS tape back and also put up a new flyer in your hometown. Interesting art project or stupid idea by stupid man that should be ashamed of himself.
Can you imagine putting 10 years into this? So John, you were a big fan of whimsy and being creative and these type of things, but this is retarded, right?
Yes,
Tom, it is retarded.
If it's all big gag, then I think like after a couple of months, if he makes it available on YouTube or whatever, then I think it's funny and cool. You know, if he doesn't, then it's like, what's the point? As Bruce Riley says, what's the point of making something if you're not going to tell anybody about it? You know, and so, you know,
We'll work on it for 10 years and then make it virtually a team that no one watches. Yeah. Be on Amazon Prime and I'll go right by and go, nah, I'm not watching that.
No one.
Like I just did with the Jawbreaker documentary.
no one puts money towards stuff for an incredibly limited release unless they're totally crazy that they don't want the world to hear. So I know John's going to bring up that Wu-Tang record that Skrelly bought, but. Yeah.
But they made money off that. They made $2 million off that.
They had to record an album or not. Maybe. We don't really know. And it was a CDR at the end of the day, wasn't it?
It was.
$2 million freaking CDR. Things start to fade after a few plays.
so all summer long, every month, the Dirty Nail has been releasing a like two-song cover set. Of them covering like these like really, really famous kind of like classic rock songs. They've been doing it all summer long just as like a fun little thing to do. And all the press for these have always been like, and this is a pet peeve of mine, but they'll go and they've been like, oh, the Dirty Nil have like two new covers out. They're covering, you know, like Queen Bitch and The Kids Are All Right or something, right? And they'll go put that out. But they're leaving out the fact that, like, no, all those songs, those covers existed. Like, they were not created for this summer to be released. Like, those were covers that they had in their back catalog. But
in the can, so to speak.
In the can. But where they were in the can was that a few years ago, they went and they recorded all these covers at once. They put them on an 8-track, of which they made 15. Ugh. 15 of these 8-tracks, and they released them for like record store.
It cost like $60 a piece to duplicate.
Yeah, so
I had to get a piece of equipment. Had to literally get in their DeLorean and go back in time to get the equipment to do it.
Right. So there was 15 of these fuckers made. Right. Even if you got one, you know, good luck in actually checking if like the audio is actually on there. Right. Like
I'm going on Discogs.
Well, like I say that we're like, I had a band that sent me a fucking floppy disk that they put a song on the other day. And I'm like, you could be lying that it's actually on this floppy disk. And I have no means of.
Well, they're sitting there smoking weed, right? These bands are all sitting around smoking weed and they're like, what are we going to do to separate ourselves from every other band? And this is what they came up with. It's a foolproof plan. Everybody's gonna love this idea, and then they
right
do it.
But what I mean though is
we're not high when we listen to it.
Is that so? You know, the Nil didn't smoke a bunch of weed and then record an 8-track and then just leave it at that. They smoked a bunch of weed and then recorded an 8-track and then sat on those songs until this summer when they had a tour to promote, and then they, you know, put the songs out on YouTube where people can find them. That's going to be the same thing with this. So this guy will go do this, you know, this secret project about mailing VHS cassette tapes around. Whether or not anyone actually partakes in it isn't important, but it got us talking about it. It got it on Punk News and everything else. And then in a year, he'll put it on YouTube. Guaranteed.
Boy, they did. Dirty Nil did do a bunch of 7-inches, didn't they?
Well, they've done a bazillion 7-inches, but the
Here it's called You're Welcome.
You're Welcome,
8-track.
Right? Yeah.
Let's see what it's called.
Melvins did it first.
Whatever, John. Melvins did everything first. We know the Melvins did everything first.
It's true.
Metallica, Cheap Trick.
Let's wrap it up with another band that does radical moves and confusing moves and leaves people scratching their head. Ceremony, they're streaming the new album. The new album is called In the Spirit World Now. It's got kind of a new wavy, dark wavy vibe to it. They did a Ask Me Anything on Reddit, and people kept asking them, are you sad that you left hardcore behind? And they kept saying, no, we're happy. We hate hardcore. They didn't say we hate hardcore. They kind of insinuate they don't care about hardcore punk anymore. Did you guys check this out?
No.
What do you think of it? And should John should John go see Morrissey or Ceremony because it's the same day?
I would say neither.
I have a vote on that. I mean, I haven't checked this out yet for no other reason than, you know, four slots. But everything that people have been saying about it seems like it would be up my alley. Like someone said it had kind of like Devo vibes the other day.
Yeah,
and I'm like,
nah, more like Gary Newman, honestly.
I'm all about Gary Newman. Like, I've, half the shit I listen to these days are just Ape and Gary Numan, right? So I'm more interested to go sit down and listen to this than I have like Ceremony being a hardcore band. So I am for it for that reason. You know, should you go see Ceremony or Morrissey? I say go see Ceremony.
Because they won't cancel.
Yeah. Well, they won't cancel. You know, they're doing.
How many times have you seen Morrissey, John?
Once.
Really?
You know what? Ceremony? What about Ceremony?
Four.
Yeah, you got to go see Morrissey.
But Ceremony is a vibrant band that is taking risks. Way.
He's going to get hit by a double-decker bus.
Morrissey is just an old racist kook that you know.
Plus, you know, John's dying to see Interpol.
Actually, I'm dying not to see Interpol. I mean, I saw them once open for The Cure. It was so boring. I mean,
wow, you saw Interpol as much as you've seen Morrissey.
I know. Ceremony, you know, they change every tour, which is interesting, and they usually have really cool tour only versions of their records. The other side of it, though, is that they're becoming more pretentious, and I don't particularly appreciate it. However, Morrissey, I've seen him once, it was an amazing show. But on the other hand, it's just Morrissey doing Morrissey. I've seen it once, and this tour is kind of the same as his past few other tours. So I don't know.
Did you hear that, Adam? John's concerned about Ceremony being too pretentious as he talks about Morrissey.
Ceremony's more pretentious than Morrissey, I think. From an artistic standpoint.
Well, I mean, and, you know,
of course, he's more hoity-toity.
Again, I'm making fun of Morrissey. I don't hate Morrissey. And I've never seen him, but I probably wouldn't go too far out of my way for it either.
When I saw him, I mean, this is before he started saying really whacked out stuff. When I saw him about 2 years ago, it really was an amazing – I mean, I talked about it on the podcast. It was an amazing show. It really was.
Well, and, you know, that's always tough too because you're always – that's going to – you know, that was the standard.
Yeah.
So it's always going to be hard to – you know, it's all these – you know, I go see – in more recent years, like I'll go see NoFX and I'll be like, ugh, it just was not very good. But the kids are like, oh man, that show was so great. But you know, I had actually seen them play great shows. So I had that standard and these kids, this was the only time they'd ever seen them. So they thought it was great. You know, yeah.
So one vote for Morrissey, one vote for Ceremony. We'll see.
Yeah,
we'll see.
I vote for Ceremony. I feel like Morrissey is like,
I bet you it'd save you a lot of dough to go see Ceremony over Morrissey.
I mean, $20 either way.
Morrissey is like one. He's one ill comment away from
death in June.
From yeah,
dude, he's, I would just stuff my pockets full of beef jerky, just because, and then just stand there and eat the beef jerky.
I mean, he's crossed the line in my mind from being like adorably curmudgeonly, like you know. You can't look at Morrissey these days and just go, "Oh, Omaz, you asshole! You're just doing your thing." I don't know. I keep seeing him pop up in situations where I'm like,
Adam, you
I don't
want to
give you
say,
money.
Looking at these situations, though, unfortunately, we live in this era of sort of gotcha media, where especially the really left leaning news sites seem to take great joy in like these takedowns. And then, a lot of times when you read past the headlines, it's not as cut and dried as they'd let you believe. So you gotta read beyond the headlines, Adam. I think Morrissey's a pretentious pud, but I don't think he's a right wing extremist based on what I've read beyond the headlines.
I think that Morrissey is enough of a dick in his general nature, though, that he would. He would lean into the whatever aspersions are being cast upon his good character and just make it worse for himself, which is only going to turn around and make it worse for John. And he's already just teetering on the edge of the algorithm sending in the Terminators to eliminate.
Go to both, John. Well, maybe Ceremony be playing about the see because Morrissey's probably playing at a big place. The show will probably be over by 10 o'clock. Then you can run across town and still catch half a Ceremony.
Yeah, we'll see. Honestly, I'm going to decide on set lists. I think I'm going to check out set lists before the shows and see what's doing.
So lame. It's so
I know,
lame.
But
I mean, I'm not saying I've never done it, but it's lame.
I hear you. But listen, I got to make difficult choices.
How does one do that?
Let's go to Setlist FM and look at the last couple nights.
There's a website? Fuck, I didn't know that. Okay.
It's probably banned in your next country.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that was a thing that people did.
Do you really know that, Tom? I mean, Adam? I mean, honestly,
If I'm writing a review or something, once in a while, if I don't know a song or I can't pick a song out, I'll cheat on one of those Setlist places. I prefer not to do it because I prefer to be surprised.
Yeah. I almost never look at the Setlist before the show, but like, if I'm deciding which band I want to go see, sometimes I'll take a peek.
But it's also easy to kind of judge a band. If they play the same set list every night, in the back of your mind, you go, oh, sort of lame.
Disagree. I disagree.
I look at them and go, oh, they're mixing it up every night. That's cool, you know?
I disagree, Tom, and not to drag out this episode, but I used to agree with you, but now I disagree 100%, and here's why. The Melvins changed my mind. But the Melvins do radically different sets every tour, but every set on the tour is the same. And the Melvins say, we play these songs in this order, kind of like you listen to an album. We want these songs to be juxtaposed against each other for a certain atmosphere or texture or however you phrase it. We're not a jukebox band, kind of like Rancid is, where we just play this song, we play that song. There's a reason why we play songs in the set, to create a certain tension, to create a certain, you know, atmosphere, feeling, and energy, and what's the word I'm looking for? Not propulsion, but... moving forward, you know what I mean?
Well, you know, as usual, John, you found the Melvins to be the exception to every rule, but and that's cool. It works for them. I mean, if that works for them, but I in general terms, I think it's sort of lame.
But you're only going to one show, so what difference does it make?
I don't know. It makes a difference.
Fair enough. I'm going to play a track by a band called Blue Anxiety. Blue Anxiety, I think it's a New York group. It's two guys. And it's kind of like goth synth punk. And
neo-Nazis, probably.
Not neo-Nazis, because at least one of them is Latino. And yeah. And they might be Morrissey fans.
Isn't that guilt by association?
I think they only have about six songs, and they're one of these bands that do it well, and that they're kind of serious, but they're also kind of self-aware. This song is called Castlemania WrestleMania, and I love it. And this is Blue Anxiety, and we'll be back to wrap up the show. that was Blue Anxiety out of New York. Adam White, today's episode. Edgy, too edgy, not edgy enough.
I mean, for you, problematically edgy. I'm squeaky clean over here. Tom's kind of in the middle.
Fair enough.
Well, I really wanted this to. I'm using this as a launch pad for my new spinoff, which is Tom Trauma Talks Vibrators. It's just going to be me every week talking about different branded vibrators and other sex toys.
And you can reach the podcast at punknews.org. We'll see you next week.